Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books in Sociology podcast channel. I am Deidre Tyler, host of the channel. Today, we'll be talking to Rafia Zakaria, author of Against Feminism, Notes on Disruption. Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Great. I would wonder if you could start by saying a few words about yourself and how you became interested in this project.
So, my name is Rafia Zakaria. I am a writer, mostly of opinion columns, and also a lawyer. And I'm a Pakistani American, but now I think I've lived more of my life in the U.S. than I have full-time in Karachi, Pakistan, where I'm from. In terms of the impetus for this book, I think, most immigrants have an inside outside perspective. And so I've kind of been involved in a lot of different things, all of which have kind of led to this moment where, I wanted a text that would reveal to white women, particularly the white women that are interested in being allies for women of color, to understand what it feels like to inhabit the skin of, for instance, in my case, being a brown Muslim woman. And some of it also came from the frustration that I saw. I've been in academia, I've been in the practice of law. Of course, now I've been a writer for about almost 10 years. And was that, there is space being that is made for women of color, Black and brown and Asian and Latinx women. But they remain, it remains still very tokenized and very peripheral. So, for instance, if, there's Black History Month or Women's History Month, you'll get books or discussions around these topics. But the inordinate number of, or like the large swath of mainstream discourse continues to be centered around white women, and in particular, white upper middle class women. And what I wanted to do is to expose how whiteness, or rather white supremacy and its history, in the United States and the Western world at large has allowed white women to become the feminists in chief or the supreme feminists, who then dictate the agenda for Black and Brown and other women of color. And the consequence of this dominance and the fact that nobody has really ever questioned or looked at how it operates, not just in the media or even historically, but in nearly every sphere of public interaction. And in the case of the United States, this feminism is then also exported abroad, as the feminism that all other women and all other parts of the world must copy. And, the better they are at copying it, the more, quote unquote, empowered they're understood they're then labeled to be. As someone who grew up in what I would call the quote unquote other part of the world, and then someone who has worked and been part of the public conversation in the US, I felt that as a brown woman, that impact is not something that white women have reckoned with. In many cases, white women have, or don't want to consider the premise that white privilege and white supremacy in the culture at large has contributed to their feminist victories. So that was kind of the intellectual project behind the book. I think the emotional project motivation behind the book was that, like most brown, Black women, I have white women who are my friends, who I'm close to. And I've always felt that I didn't have a launching pad from where to begin a conversation about race within the feminist movement. And so I wanted to have write a text that would allow for that starting point, that would create the context for that conversation. Because I believe that, that conversation about race among feminists is absolutely and urgently necessary.
Well, you started the book off talking about going to a bar in Manhattan with a group of women. Tell us about that story and why it's so significant.
That story is significant because I've lived so many versions of it. So many times, it didn't just happen once, where I am with women, most of whom, and in the media and publishing, white women dominate. They're second only to white men. And I think they're actually set to overtake white men, like in the publishing world. And, so it's an environment of like, developing some camaraderie, doing some networking, getting to know each other. But there is this undertone of that I have always felt as a woman of color, of trying to belong to a conversation in which my past, as I talk about that, or my past as a single mother, my past as someone who lived in a shelter, my past as an immigrant, et cetera, my present as a Muslim woman is all sort of it's something that I that I have to sort of sweep under the rug, so to speak, because I have to pretend to belong to this white upper middle class version of how we get along. So the point of that example is that, or what I'm trying to show in any case, is how a lot of women of color feel like they have to pretend to be white, to be, you know, in the feminist sisterhood. And such that there isn't much effort to delineate what aspects of feminism are just white, you know, whiteness or white culture, and what are actually aspects that are focused on empowering women. And that has happened because, like I said, white women are considered the universal subject. You know, so when you talk about quote unquote woman, it's always white and largely white middle-class women's concerns that are centered in the feminist conversation. And the rest of us have to sort of just pretend and omit and file away, you know, the parts of us that don't fit into those boxes.
So someone would say, what's wrong with rich white women being the rescue persons of brown and black women? How would you answer that question?
You know, that's a great question. And the central problem with it is that it has created, you know, the white woman savior model of feminism has created a hierarchy within feminism so that, you know, white women are at the top and they're dictating the feminist agenda. And then it's their qualities and sort of, you know, cultural iterations that are being held up as the feminist, or the most feminist qualities. And everyone else's concerns and everyone else's, you know, priorities, everyone else's qualities are sort of sidelined as not that important. And it's also, of course, created the situation where I don't think, you know, for instance, I mean, I give a lot of examples in the book about, you know, personal experiences that I've had in which I see either myself or other women of color be put in positions where they supply stories of trauma and stories of suffering. And then the policy work or the agenda setting or the leadership is all white women. And this has essentially meant that, you know, brown and black women have not had the opportunity to delineate what is important, you know, what is important to them. And I'll give you an example. It's a historical example, but it's an example in the book. And it comes from, you know, the time right after the suffrage movement. So in the time right after the suffrage movement, there were a lot of British suffragists that, you know, were going to India to sort of drum up what they, you know, thought would be a suffragist movement in India, right, for Indian women. And the problem with that was that, you know, India at the time was a British colony. So nobody in India was free at that time. And so these suffragists went to some of the prominent feminists in India at the time. And all of those women were engaged in the anti-colonial struggle to be free from British rule. And these white women go to them and they say, well, but don't you want the vote? Don't you want to be able to vote? Don't you want to be equal to men? And the brown woman said, I don't want to be equal, they said, to brown men, because brown men are suffering under the yoke of British rule, just like we are. So we want freedom first, and freedom from British rule first. And then we, you know, immediately want the vote. So, and, you know, and I present that example because it really shows this kind of blindness that a lot of white women have to even the idea that other women might have agendas and concerns that are, you know, that are different from their own, and that don't make sense, you know, in terms of their lives. So, you know, and the problem is that the absence of, or, you know, the absence of this ability to see that other women would prioritize different things is, I mean, it's not just in the past. Another example from the book is the example of the Clean Stove campaign in India, which is run by the UN and other agencies, and you know, and in which a lot of white women, from environmentalists to you know, women's groups to you know, a lot of other women who have leadership positions in the UN or in NGOs or civil society in general that contributes to this kind of development project. And they said, okay, well, these women in rural India and Rajasthan, they use these wood-burning stoves. And these wood-burning stoves are smoky and they, you know, just, you know, they pollute and they use up fossil fuels in terms of like the wood. And so we have these new stoves, these new clean stoves. And we're going to give them all these new clean stoves. And this is I believe like a $1 billion project over that was in a span over a decade. And we're going to give these new clean stoves to these women, and they're going to use them, and it's going to be a victory, a win-win for everybody. You know, because the environmentalists will be happy because they won't be collecting collecting wood for their stoves, and the women's groups will be happy because now the women, because they don't have to search for wood, and because they can cook faster, will be able to work. And when once they're able to work, they'll, you know, have economic power, and then, you know, that economic power will allow them to have more decision-making power within the family, and on, right? And what happened was that these stoves were supplied for years, and Indian women in Rajasthan refused to use them. And so there began this question of like, why don't these women use these stoves, these clean stoves? Why are they still reverting to their wood-burning stoves? And finally, someone actually went and asked the women themselves why they didn't do that. And the answer was that the wood stove, along with, you know, the process of going out and collecting the wood, played a very important part in these women's lives. First of all, they felt like they, you know, I mean, there were actual like technical problems in that, you know, these are far-flung villages and the clean stoves would break and then there would be no one to fix them. or, you know, it wasn't something like the wood stove, which the women could essentially put together themselves. Second was that, and more interestingly, was that they said that, look, we like going out and searching for this wood with our friends. This is a very crucial part of our village sisterhood, where we exchange information, we help each other out, we, you know, try to solve our problems. It's very much a part of our lives. We don't want to, you know, it's part of our sisterhood, and we don't want to lose that. And then they also said that in terms of like the jobs that would be available to us if we used these other stoves, are just menial jobs where we would be doing things like splitting rocks or carrying rocks for road projects and things like that. And, you know, it's not even a subsistence salary. So why should we give up our tradition and what we see as our culture of sisterhood to go, you know, carry rocks in some construction site that's far from our village? So point, of course, the larger point is that, you know, when you have this system where you have women at the top, with this kind of white woman savior mentality, not only do they not listen, but it's really like they truly do not, in my opinion, understand that other women might prioritize things differently, or that they should have some parity in deciding how, you know, in this case, millions and millions of dollars are spent. So you have this enormous failure of this multi-million dollar program. And, you know, I believe that the core of it was this hierarchy within feminism, in which white women believe that they are essentially, they have the right to make the agenda, and that all other women should then quietly implement that agenda and congratulate white women for having come up with it. And, you know, as I lay out in the book, I mean, these are just a couple of examples. That book has a lot of them from many different parts of, you know, life and feminist activism. And it shows that this sort of mentality is not just, you know, like, oh, good intentions, that they just wanted to help. It actually has, you know, it has an emotional cost, it has a societal cost, and it has an actual, you know, like an actual dollar cost in many cases. You know, and I could go on and on. I mean, you know, we're withdrawing from Afghanistan at the end of this month. I mean, the PROMOTE program that the U.S. implemented in Afghanistan, it was the same sort of thing where, you know, it was a job training program for Afghan women. And it was such a complete failure that even after spending over $100 million, you know how many women, Afghan women were trained from this program? Less than 10, literally less than 10. So, I mean, it's time that we kind of, all of us feminists, all of us women, had this uncomfortable conversation about race, and started being honest, so that, you know, these resources that have the potential to, you know, do so much good are not just wasted because these conversations didn't take place.
Well, you gave a lot of examples of Black women and historically what they went through. Do you see that there's a difference among women of color and their stories and needs? I want you to explain that a little.
Well, I mean, I'm not suggesting in the book that, you know, all women of color even have the same histories or the same, the same priorities. Nor is the book arguing for, like, you know, some sort of very idealistic kumbaya that has to happen even amongst women of color. I think that there are, there are tremendous differences between even women of color. I mean, you said, you spoke specifically about Black women. I mean, you know, I think within the American context, it is absolutely undoubted that Black women have suffered more than absolutely, and continue to suffer more than absolutely any other group. I truly think that, and I think that that is the reality. But I think that acknowledgement also, for me personally, imputes a sense of deference to them, because they have endured so much within the American context. But what the book tries to do is to show that, for instance, Indian women have, women, all the women who lived under British colonialism have endured a similar kind of servitude and continue to endure it. But the nub of white supremacy that is behind the suffering of Black women historically and today is very, it's the same, you know, it comes from the same place. This white and Western project of colonizing the world and settler colonialism. And they did the same thing, whether, you know, they came over to America and then started to import slaves, whether they went over to India and, you know, declared that all women, I mean, I talk, for instance, in the book where about how they passed laws which essentially said that nearly all women are prostitutes, brown women in India, the British did. And, you know, the sort of draconian forced genital examinations that were put in place because of that, the fact that, you know, the bodies of Indian women, because, you know, when they did that, when they, labeled all these women prostitutes and then they caught them doing petty crimes, what they could then do is put all these women in prison. And then they took those women and essentially used them as slaves in other colonizing places. So, you know, I mean, it was a very clever way of essentially creating, you know, making Indian women into slaves. And the genesis of all of that is this central issue. And, you know, I think that there are very good, excellent African-American women who have written in particular about the struggles of Black women. But what my book tries to do is to try to show how those ideas, like what the American state does to Black women and to their bodies, is something they have replicated all over the world, that same kind of idea of domination. And, whether it's the sort of degradation of other cultures, whether it's, there are innumerable examples. So I wanted, for example, for Black women, you know, to understand how their experience their, you know, historical legacy of slavery, and then now continued discrimination more than, like I said, any other group, is connected to this larger sort of international project of, you know, dominating and demeaning all other brown, Asian, Latinx women around the world. It's also a story of how those ideas of white supremacy are proliferated and entrenched in so much of the world where, you know, whether it's development projects, whether it's sort of cultural framing, all of it, so that they would have, I think, a text that showed them the connection between the life of, say, a young African American, you know, college student at, you know, at, say, City University or City College where I taught in Harlem, and a young girl in Pakistan. There are connections there, and I wanted, or I hope, that all these different women will be able to see them.
You know, we're looking at a new generation of women today, and they have so many opportunities that I'm just seeing that we know the historical past, but today things are open for all women.
They're open for all women, theoretically. I don't believe, I mean, they're open for Black and Brown and Latinx and Asian women to the extent that they follow a white model of success. And, are, you know, and I mean, to the extent that they get entry into them. You know, I mean, I definitely faced a lot of discrimination in terms of, you know, when I first graduated from law school, and it's because, you know, the image of the young female lawyer is a white woman, and it's proliferated by judges, it's proliferated by just many institutions, and to the extent that there are minority women, it's expected that they're going to work, like, you know, not for the top law firms, but, like, you know, as a public defender or as a prosecutor at best. So I think that it's important for women of color and girls of color to absolutely take up any and all opportunities that are available to them. But, you know, with the opening of more opportunities than before, I mean, you're absolutely right in saying that there are more opportunities than existed before. But I also fear that unless we have this conversation, you know, women of color are just gonna have to pretend to be white if they want to make it, you know, basically. So the better you are at doing that, the more, you know, you dress white, the more you talk white. I ended up working at a civil rights law firm that was all African American. And I guess, except for me as a Pakistani American. And that was another place where I learned how, you know, and how women of color just don't inhabit the same world that white women do. And it appears the thing I worry about the most is that now they are becoming more visible and getting farther than they did before. And the closer they get to sort of parity with white women, to the or try to get there, to get to parity with white women, the more sort of hidden ways of perpetuating racism are evolving. I mean, just today, I wrote a CNN piece on, you know, the ESPN anchor, Rachel Nichols, who was caught on tape saying that, you know, the Black woman that got her spot was only there because, you know, they're doing the diversity thing and they're not going to be able to get rid of me because this is my thing. So, I mean, it's a hurtful, very hurtful conversation to listen to as a woman of color, but I think it's a conversation that I know happens among white people all the time, and a conversation that they don't believe is racist when it is. So, so you know, I mean, I do feel like that there is an urgency to this, in that, you know, that unless we sort of have this difficult conversation, honestly, I think feminism is, I mean, in terms of its ability to actually empower and produce change for all women, will be, you know, will be dead because of this belief that white women have, that they won the space that they occupy from white men. And now how dare women of color encroach on that space? And what I'm saying is that, you know, some of the reason white women have that space is because they're white, you know, and whiteness confers tremendous amounts of privilege and opportunities that the rest of us don't have.
You made some really good comments about what you saw in our society, and you said about the white women wanting parity with white men at any cost.
Right.
Talk to us more about that.
Well, I mean, you know, it is, I guess something I haven't talked about yet is the model of success. I mean, in addition to all the other sort of, you know, what I would say genealogical histories of how obviously whiteness has dominated in America, in the world, there is, you know, the feminist movement was by and large a white movement. And I go through take a lot of pains in the book to show how it continues to be a white, largely white movement. And the, you know, take, like, for instance, the Women's March. I mean, you know, most of the women who could participate in it, who had the money, who had the time, who could get a hotel, and who honestly felt safe enough to do that, were white. And so, yes, I mean, I think that there is a sense of entitlement in white women, in that they are pushing for equality with white men. And there almost seems to be a sense of disbelief among them that all the other women are not grateful to them for doing that. And that issue is a very problematic one. And, you know, I go again to, like, this article that I've recently written about this female anchor, because, you know, in different sections of it, of the tape, and in other interviews, she talks about, you know, how she's put in the time, and she's put in, you know, she's done all the right things, and how dare this Black woman come take her place. And I mean, you know, her words could be the words of, like, quite literally millions of white women all over America. The corporate capitalist model of sort of, you know, lean in, the lean-in feminism, that is the dominant feminism, at least among white women, you know, who work in corporate America and are part of that capitalist economy. That's the goal, is to keep be you know, louder and pushier and more sort of dominant than white men so that you can get ahead. But that sort of individualistic model of feminism that essentially sees, they're more than happy to throw everyone else under the bus if it ensures their own ascent. And that is the model that I'm calling out, because I think that it's that model and what, as you know, as you quoted, this idea of getting ahead at any cost, that I think has really in some ways been a death blow for feminism, simply because it's this idea that achievement is only possible if you work alone, you know, or with other white women who look like you, who come from the same class background, et cetera, et cetera. And what I'm prescribing is, you know, a model that is truly sort of focused on sisterhood and on solidarity and on this idea that, you know, if we work collectively, at least on some dimension, we women of all colors can also, that also can produce incredible achievement. But that sort of working together is not happening because, like I said, there are all these, you know, it's Sex and the City is promoted white, you know, white general culture as, you know, this feminist and empowered culture. And, you know, other aspects show, one of the things, for instance, that I see all the time lately is stories of how the first white women who discovered this or who did that, or, you know, there was a story, you know, that I saw one time just tweeted on Twitter, which was like the first white women who traveled the length of the Colorado River, you know, this is their story. And or they didn't say first white women, I'm sorry, the first women. And I was like, well, they might be the first white women, but they're not the first women. Surely there were a lot of Native peoples living around that very area that almost certainly, were on the Colorado River and would have, you know, traversed it. And the point being is nothing is considered done until a white woman does it. So when a white woman does it, it's suddenly worth doing. Oh, and it's always, that white woman representing all women. So, the first woman to discover, to work as a scientist, for instance, they would have. And of course, it'd be a white woman. And then, you know, all the rest of us were supposed to kind of get behind that. And there's a problem there because you're not telling the stories of different kinds of lives, of different kinds of achievement. You know, one example of different in terms of different kinds is that, I take the women that I knew growing up in Pakistan, and they weren't rebellious, but they were very resilient, and they raised families and they educated their kids and they did a lot of things that were very, take my own mother, like she got into the car and drove halfway across a very crowded and crime-ridden city so that I could go to this amazing all-girls school. And So, you know, resilience is also, rebellion is important, but resilience is also important. But we never really, center a discourse around that, because it's assumed that, you know, a brown woman is only really worthy of the feminist label if she rebels.
You know, you brought out a lot of good information, and I want to thank you for the book. What would you say the solution would be, because of all the chaos that's going on with women of all colors?
I think in the immediate sense, the solution is really for white women to recognize that the discomfort that they might feel, you know, for instance, from reading a book like Against White Feminism, is the discomfort that women of color feel all the time. So it's this, there's a necessity to acknowledge that other people who are not white don't get to be themselves almost all the time, unless they're, you know, around just their own family or whatever. And I think that if white women truly recognize that, they would be able to do so much good, and they would be able to come to the conversation from such a place of openness. That's what I would say in the near term. In the larger space, the books, you know, and devotes like the last part precisely to the fact that, you know, empowerment, even the word empowerment, was coined by brown feminists from a collective in India. And they understood that to mean a political struggle against misogynist institutions and patriarchy. And if, you know, all of us women together are to resuscitate feminism, because I do believe, and it's in a place where it needs resuscitation, it is in the recognition that this is centrally a political struggle. It's not a struggle of just more economic opportunity. It's not a struggle of just changing laws. It's a political struggle that requires women to evaluate the cost of their decisions on other women, and to organize politically around that premise. I think that until feminism becomes political again, it can't be the force that it has the potential to be.
Well, I've taken up a lot of your time, and I've enjoyed the conversation. Can you tell the audience, what are you working on next?
What I'm working on next? Well, the next book, I think, is going to be an examination of marriage, not in terms of, you know, just marriage equality, but in terms of, you know, I had an arranged marriage when I was 17 years old. And I was in that marriage for almost a decade. And so the next book is going to tell the story of that marriage, and then what it has made me think about, and what it has taught me about the nature of love and the nature of that, you know, very central human relationship.
Thank you so much.
You're so welcome.